Concerns about the coronavirus. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. While there are no known cases of the coronavirus in South Florida, according to the State Health Department, this week two big festivals were canceled over worries about the disease, the Ultra Music Festival and the Caiocho Festival. Will the cancellations help protect public health? How is Miami Beach preparing for what is usually a crowded spring break season in this new environment? What questions do you have about the virus? And has it changed your daily routines? Plus, one reporter's firsthand experience navigating the health system with a respiratory illness in this age of coronavirus concerns. Your phone calls coming up next here on the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Our program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week and supporting public radio. Spring break is underway, but this year it comes with worries over the virus here. Tens of thousands of people, college students and families alike, annually come to South Florida for some sun and sand and fun over a spring break season. Some business conferences scheduled for March have already been canceled, and Ultra and the Caiocho Festival in Miami have officially been called off. Spring break is not so much a single event, certainly, but rather a stretch of time with people coming to South Florida. So has the coronavirus changed your plans for hospitality? If you work in the hospitality industry, has it affected your job? Has the threat or concern about the virus changed your daily routine? The phone lines are open now, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Your questions, your concerns about the coronavirus and COVID-19, 800-743-9576. You can also send us a text to 786-786-7636. The text line, if you'd like to communicate that way, is 786-786-7636. Let's begin with Jimmy Morales, the city manager of Miami Beach. Jimmy, welcome to WLRN. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Tom.
Has the coronavirus affected your expectations for spring break visitors to the beach?
Well, we don't have numbers yet, but we anticipate that some folks will not come, in response to that. We don't know how significant that's going to be. We have found that, like when we had Zika a few years ago, that the younger tourists were a little less afraid, maybe, and particularly since this coronavirus, I know, has been particularly sensitive with older populations, it may well be they don't have that same level of sensitivity, but we anticipate there'll be some decline.
Is the city doing anything differently to prepare? As I mentioned, spring break already underway with some universities and will continue to kind of roll through for the next several weeks.
Yeah, no, we got kids already here. I mean, they've been out on beaches the last couple of days, so we know they're here. We're doing a few different things. Obviously, number one, with respect to our own facilities, our parks where we have our kids, our own government buildings, et cetera, we have heightened our, cleaning protocols. We have put out, sanitizers. We have put out hand washing stations. We're doing an activation on the beach from 10th to 6th. Where we're doing some positive programming, some and whatnot. We're going to have hand washing stations and sanitizers out there. We're working with the hospitality industry to make sure they're doing what they need to be doing. In our convention center, we're doing the same kind of thing. So we're taking all the precautions necessary. We're communicating daily with all the applicable authorities, state, county, health department, taking the cue of whatever direction they give us. To date, they have not said to cancel anything or to, turn tourists away. And so we're not doing that yet, but we're monitoring the situation, of course.
800-743-WLRN is the telephone number if you have questions, comments about the coronavirus. 800-743-9576. Jimmy Morales, the Miami Beach City Manager, is with us. What's the guidance to healthcare providers, to urgent care centers, and even to that elderly population that calls Miami Beach home still in those nursing homes?
Well, our fire department has been coordinating with the other fire rescue agencies here in the county, and they've developed a protocol when calls come in that could be corona-related. The fire rescue units, they work closely with their local hospitals. In the case of Miami Beach, for example, where we have Mount Sinai, we've been in communication with them. They feel they're ready. Their medical chief medical officers are in communication with our fire rescue folks. So, and that includes obviously our rescue folks having the gear they need to protect themselves as well as to provide care, and I think the same in the hospitals and our police officers as well, because as first responders, they may come upon situations where that's relevant. So,
Jimmy, when you're talking about gear like that, are you talking about those N95 masks? Are you talking about full body plastic suits?
I think we're talking more about masks. I mean, I don't think we're talking about full plastic. I can't speak to the hospital, but I think just making sure what they try to do is by when a call comes in to 911, for example, somebody who might be in distress, questions are asked to try to identify if there are some of the factors that might be relevant. Were they traveling? Have they come in contact with someone who traveled? And then the fire department will alert the crews who are responding. Yeah. And that will also maybe perhaps determine whether they take him to a hospital.
Jimmy, hold on the line here.
Protocols.
Let me bring in Dr. Lillian Abouch, the Chief of Infection Prevention and Control at Jackson Health System. Doctor, thank you for joining us. When you hear the city manager talking about that special protection, I saw you make a motion around your eyes. You're talking about some eye protection as well?
Yes. Hi. Good afternoon, and thank you for having me here. I think it's important that for medical personnel and EMS personnel, what is unique about this virus compared to the flu virus, for example, is that the protective equipment also has to have eye protection, especially if you have to do emergency intubations on the field or people are actively coughing. We want to make sure that there is eye protection, the mask protection, and of course, hand hygiene and gloves. It's really what we call the contact precautions and taking it to droplet precautions and eye protection. I think that's the main difference.
Doctor, when you hear the city manager of Miami Beach talk about some of the preventative measures and education they're doing on the beach with a lot of visitors, how do you hear that? What do you make of that? And how does the hospitality industry kind of import some best practices here?
I think it's extremely positive and reassuring. I think as a citizen, it's really great to hear that all these measures are being taken. I think it's reassuring the public that this is not a crisis, that you don't have to be in panic, but you do have to be prepared and working on hand hygiene and environmental cleaning, which are something that are very easy to do and that anyone can do it. But knowing that the city is taking the steps is fantastic. I think working with the school systems is as important to educate the children and educate our teachers.
We're going to take some of your phone calls here in a moment. 800-743-WLRN. That's our voice line. 800-743-9576. You could also send us a text at 786-786-7636. Text safely, of course, at 786-786-7636. Jimmy Morales, the city manager at Miami Beach. What about cleaning public spaces and public surfaces? Have you stepped up in any kind of activity there?
Well, like I said, in terms of all of our facilities, including the ones that interact with the public, we are going into senior homes and whatnot to try to educate them on what they need to be doing. There's a lot of them do get some public support. But we have a lot of facilities where we have seniors, like we have a senior center in North Beach, our parks where kids are at. So in those areas, we've raised, like I said, the level of the kind of supplies we use to make sure they're effective against the virus. But we're also providing information because obviously part of it, as the doctor said, is the educational. So we have provided that kind of information to the industry. In fact, on Monday, we're convening a meeting with all the hotel managers on Miami Beach to provide them some of the protocols and try to educate them, both in terms of how they can better prepare their facilities and at the same time hear from the medical, our fire rescue folks about identifying issues and being responsive. Because to some degree, they're sometimes the first responders when somebody in their hotel gets sick and,
right,
they reach out to them, try to educate them to be as prepared as possible as well.
You'll probably also hear about hotel occupancy and business, I imagine, with those hotel managers. Customer service.
Exactly.
Customer service software company Zendex had been scheduled for a big conference at the Miami Beach Convention Center this week. Over 2,000 people were expected to be there. It was over 2,000 hotel nights. That was canceled. What kind of impact for that conference, and what are you hearing from the convention center, Jimmy?
Well, obviously, they've been in communication with their customers, the shows. We've actually had three events canceled. We had Zendek, We had a show called Tissue World, and I forget the name of the third one, and a group in May that have already canceled. We have had some other groups that say they're moving forward, but that, you know, that is the issue. Sometimes with these groups, it's not necessarily even that they're concerned about the issues here, but it, with many of these groups, particularly like Tissue World, which was a very international show, it's sometimes that their vendors can't make it. The folks who are coming to attend the show now can't make it or are afraid to travel. And so for some of them, it's also an economic decision that if they're going to have half the vendors and half the attendees, it may not be worth putting on the show. So a lot of factors go into it. But, no, we're concerned. Look, we've been through – we know the experience of when Zika and how it impacted our hospitality industry. We know what a hurricane or a near miss of a hurricane can do to revenues in the hospitality industry. And so we are anticipating that this will have a negative effect. How negative will obviously depend on – whether we actually have cases here, whether we have more serious situation, that's what we're monitoring very carefully. But we're in touch with the Convention Center. We're in touch with the Hotel Association. We work with the Commission Visitor Bureau. We're all sort of monitoring this and, you know, hoping that the worst doesn't arise.
Jimmy, I know we're tight on time here on this Friday afternoon, so I'll let you go. Jimmy Morales, the city manager at Miami Beach, thanks for sharing your time here with us.
Thanks, Tom. Have a great weekend.
Dr. Abba, let me ask you the response that you think about when you hear about these public events being canceled, like Ultra, like Kyocha, or these business conferences being canceled as well. Is that a prudent? Is it an abundance of caution? What do you think about that?
I think it's an abundance of caution. And again, there is no reason to be in fear and panic here right now. We have, as of 1 o'clock today, no evidence of cases in Miami. This is a very fluid situation.
Or South Florida at all.
But the situation is very fluid as we're testing more patients and people may present with respiratory symptoms, which we're still in the middle of the flu season. It's, you know, we need to do a thorough assessment of the situation and determine who really has it and doesn't. So far, we don't have cases. However, if you have children who are going to Ultra, I think it's the most prudent decision was to cancel this. There's no reason to take additional risks. So I think it was the right choice to make. Maybe an overkill? Well, time will tell.
And some of the criticism, right, is the travel plans you may not be able to cancel. So the concerts, so to speak, may not be happening. So you may not have 30,000 people in Bayfront Park over the course of 3 days and nights. But you still may have a good number of those folks still coming to the area.
Absolutely. And especially in these concerts where we know there is a lot of exchange of respiratory secretions and droplets and drinks, and there is no risk to take. The first measure that we take when we have a situation like this is to recommend social distancing. And this is what, you know, this is what social
distancing
is. This
is how it manifests itself.
Correct.
Canceled public events.
So again, Miami, for example, doesn't have the public transportation that New York City has, right? You cannot prevent 10,000 people going every hour into the subway. But why put 10,000 people together in one area if you can avoid it?
There's plenty of other big events still on the calendar. How should public officials and how should those folks that may be wanting to attend think about that? What are some of the considerations?
I think that we need to monitor the situation on a daily basis because things change, you know, on a daily basis.
Yeah.
So to predict what's going to happen a few months from now, I've had questions from colleagues. Should we cancel the Japan Olympics? Well, I cannot comment on that right now. I think we need to wait and see what happens between now and then. Of course, you don't want to start making travel plans. I would say be prudent with your travel plans. The situation may change. It may be favorable and we will be all traveling in a few weeks or may not. So I think important decisions, I would defer them. My advice is watch the situation, and we're all in this together.
Doctor, we've got a lot of calls for you that we're going to take. Some texts, if you want to get your question in that way, 786-786-7636. Again, the text line, 786-786-7636. The voice line, 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-WLRN. You can also send us a note on social media. We are on Facebook and Instagram. It is all ahead, continuing the conversation about the coronavirus and the response here in South Florida. It's up next. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Thanks again for listening this week. Florida health officials are continuing to monitor the spread of the coronavirus. According to the Florida Department of Health, more than 260 people are under public health monitoring statewide. That means people at risk of having been exposed to COVID-19. There have been three positive cases in the state of Florida. Our phone lines are open. What questions, concerns do you have about the coronavirus? 800-743-WLRN, our phone line, 800-743-9576. Dr. Lillian Abo is with us. She is the Chief of Infection Prevention and Control at Jackson Health System. Doctor, how is Jackson Health, the safety net hospital in Miami-Dade County, preparing for the first case, let alone anything more widespread?
So in Jackson, we have been very cautious, and we have a lot of experience in crisis, epidemic, and pandemic management. So this is not happening overnight. We have gone through H1N1 in 2009. We went through Zika. We've prepared for Ebola. So we have a whole team from leaders to frontline staff who have preparedness and training in managing these situations. This is a novel virus, and with any new disease, we have to learn as new information becomes available. But we are, since mid-January, we have been taking steps. We have protocols in place, and the protocols are updated almost daily and posted weekly. We have the protocols that are available for any of our employees to download, to read. We're doing training in donning and doffing protective equipment. We have started since January triaging in all our entry access points. We're limiting visitors. We're taking extra steps in protecting our public, in identifying cases rapidly, and make sure that we avoid spread of disease.
This week, the state suggested to nursing home operators that they screen visitors, not only with questions about have you traveled to the places where the outbreak has been, including China and South Korea and Italy, but also doing temporal temperature scans. Are there plans potentially to institute that kind of screening at some point?
So we have implemented, following the CDC guidance since early this week, screening of visitors, asking have they had a temperature.
So orally screening them, in other words, asking them.
Asking, have you had a fever? Do you have any respiratory symptoms? If you do, kindly do not come to the nursing home, because we do know that the nursing home residents and long-term care facility are not leaving the facility. It's either the visitors or the employees that are bringing things in there.
But nothing screening like that at the hospital itself.
We are.
We are
starting proactively, and we're starting screening visitors in the next 24 hours. We already have scripting messages at all our access point. We're finalizing those details with our security, and we're taking the same measures in our long-term care facilities that we are in the acute care hospitals.
So by Saturday, a visitor to Jackson Memorial will be asked these questions.
We should be ready to go by tomorrow. Correct.
Any idea around consideration about the temporal scan, the actual taking the temperature as opposed to just asking about a temperature?
I have concerns. We don't have the total body scanners like they have in other countries, where you can walk in a machine like a metal detector. And with oral temperature measuring, I am more concerned about the disinfection of these devices and having non-medical personnel like a security guard taking temperature on people. I think we do that for our patients, of course, after you go through triage. And again, the training that we're giving is if any visitor has a temperature, we'll defer them to the emergency department where they can be properly assessed.
Doctor, we got a lot of calls, a lot of questions here. Let's
I'll
get right
to
them. In Sanford, David, you are up first as an Uber driver. Go ahead, David. You're on the radio.
Yes, thank you for allowing me to make this phone call. I'm an Uber driver, and I do driving for about 12 hours. Now, every couple of passengers that I get, like seven people, I disinfect my vehicle. So I'm from Sanford, Florida, so if it gets close to home, what should I do? Should I stop driving or continue disinfecting the car?
So that's an excellent question. And of course, if Uber is your primary way of paying your bills and supporting your family, I cannot tell you quit your job and find something else to do overnight, correct? I think your concerns are valid. My understanding is that both Uber and Lyft are providing their drivers with education in terms of how to disinfect the car. I think you should carry hand sanitizer. Don't shake hands with your customers. I think it's important that you want to provide a good service, and you sometimes if there's luggage and things that you have to handle, handle. You really need to disinfect your hands. That's your safest measure. And of course, you know, you can ask people, you know, do you have a fever? I would have some mask. If somebody has respiratory symptoms, they should be wearing a mask and not spreading, you know, droplets in your vehicle. How feasible is that to implement? I think I would have Uber answer that question.
Allison in Jupiter, you're up next. Go ahead, Allison. You're on the radio now.
Hi, I'm a nurse practitioner in an ENT specialty clinic, and I've talked to nurse practitioners in primary care clinics, and most of our patients are going to be the population that tends to get hit by coronavirus more, which is 60 and above, especially in the Palm Beach County area. And we're also seeing patients every single day that fit all the criteria of the coronavirus, and especially since it's now so widespread, what is expected to be a feasible amount of protective equipment? It's not like we can walk in a hazmat suit or change them in between all of 20 patients that we see in a day with eye gear, N95. So we're kind of at a loss in terms of how we deal with this on a daily basis with between 20 and 30 patients that fit the general criteria. And then my second question is really, how do we go about this, especially with all of the shortages in terms of masks? Our office is trying to get stuff, but everything's on back supply.
Yeah, the supply concern. How about that first concern, Doctor?
So let's start with the first question. The first question, I think it's a public health response for the local health departments. They really, CDC and the local health departments, you're in West Palm Beach, they should be able to support you with tools on how to screen patients. We have put in our individual hospitals screening tools. I would advise that, for example, you have some scripting messaging when people are calling or scheduling their appointments, or when you confirm their appointments. If you're having respiratory symptoms and you meet this criteria, maybe we don't want you to come here and infect everyone. Maybe we need to refer you to an urgent care center where we can have testing. I think the local health departments will eventually have the capacity to start having mobile clinics or resources to test people and avoid people coming into one room and waiting. But that's really the public health response, and we're waiting to hear further guidance from the local departments of health. I think pre-screening people would be very helpful. You don't need to be on a hazmat suit. That's a misconception. I think there's a lot of hype in the media, and you really need to understand that putting a mask on that patient is the most important thing. You don't want them coughing or, you know, waiting and spreading in front of others. People that are asymptomatic should not be walking around with masks. We really want to put the mask on the person who's having the symptoms. You need to protect them from spreading, not protect everybody else.
What about the mask for the nurse practitioner?
Yes.
And do you have to switch out that mask when you go from room to room visiting two different patients?
So it depends. We can reuse the N95 respirators the same way we reuse them with patients with tuberculosis. So there is a process in place, and it's, you know, we have processes for donning and doffing, but you could use the same N95 respirator multiple times. You don't need to throw it away. I just think that for the nurse taking care of that patient, what we are recommending at this time is to use the N95 respirator, to use your goggles that you can clean and reuse, and then it's contact gowns and gloves. That's what we're doing in emergency departments, urgent care centers, and acute care hospitals. In a doctor's office, you really need to tailor it to that area, and you need to work with the local Department of Health for guidance.
Dr. Abou, you mentioned the Department of Health. You worked with the Department of Health during the Zika outbreak with those colleagues. What's your assessment so far of the Department of Health's response and communication regarding the coronavirus and the threat of COVID-19?
So I think from Tallahassee, we're getting guidance to the local departments of health. We have an integrated network of health departments across the state. They are collaborating. There's a lot of work going on right now in terms of identifying cases, and every suspected case they have to go. And once it's confirmed, they're looking at, you know, investigating all the possible contacts of those patients. I think there is a website that the Florida Department of Health has put out. I would refer everyone to the Florida Department of Health .gov, that's / right, coronavirus, and there is a hotline. Do you have it? It's 1-866-779-6121. Again, it's 1-866-779-6121. It's a hotline for any questions or concerns regarding coronavirus. It's operating. They're trying to make it operative 24/7, but at least until midnight, for sure, you will get an answer.
Let's take some more phone calls here in Coconut Creek. Kyra, go ahead. You are on line 2. Go ahead. You're on the radio now.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to offer a quick comment of perspective that my family is actually looking to travel now that prices are so cheap. My sister graduates this spring, and we're looking at cruise lines that would have been $400, $500 that are now around $200. There is a little bit of a concern that, you know, these cruise ships are kind of cesspools for the disease. The Diamond Princess definitely has us worried, but the cheap prices are a little bit too enticing.
Kira, hold on the line. I will mention that the Vice President Pence is due to meet with cruise line officials at Port Everglades on Saturday. There have been no cases at cruise ships that use Port Miami or Port Everglades, two of the busiest in the world. There is a cruise ship off the coast of California that is undergoing testing, and she mentioned the Carnival cruise line, the Princess Diamond, which was offshore in Japan, which was the source of, I think it was 700 cases in that regard. How do folks that are seeing some travel opportunities maybe in the months ahead assess the risk versus the opportunity, Doctor?
I think that's a personal decision that you have to make. You have to weigh your risk and benefits depending on, you know, where you're traveling in the cruise. And again, I know the cruise industry is making all the necessary precautions, hygiene, disinfection. But again, it's an individual risk that I would say take it. And I would observe the situation very closely as things may change. What I say today will be very different a week from today.
Just the reason you got into med school was to provide travel advice, right?
Absolutely. And be in radio instead of seeing patients.
That's right. Kathy in, Kathy, a visitor from Illinois. Kathy, welcome to Florida. What's your question?
Hi, thank you for taking the call. My question has not been addressed anywhere. And that has to do with the fact is that sometimes the elderly present with different symptoms than you or I might. An example, I read this. This was some medical experts writing for Time Medicine, Time Magazine Medicine, said that an elderly person, for example, with an infection, which could be like COVID-19, may not even have a fever, but they may show as being disoriented or more unstable or irritable, when in fact they have an infection that they may not show a fever. And an example of that would be anybody who's had an elderly relative knows that if they're being disoriented or losing, you know, their abilities in some way mentally, it might be that they have a UTI or some other infection. You take care of it and they're back to normal self. So why is this not being addressed in the public media? Everybody says, well, if they have a fever, an elderly person might have an infection but not even present with a fever. So how do you deal with that? And nobody's brought that up. Can you help me understand that?
Kathy, you're the first one. You got it, and we got the doctor. What are your thoughts here?
Hi. So thank you again for your question. I think most of the information that we're learning from this novel virus is coming from the publications of China, eventually will be Italy, and the rest of the world. So you need to understand that what we have so far is the scientific knowledge that has been published. That so far has not been the way most elderly have presented. They have not been presenting with disorientation and no fever. Most of the cases have presented this way. Can there be exceptions, and can there be patients presenting atypically? There could be, but the majority of the population where we have to do education, it's really you take the 80-20 rule. I do think that if you have a close relative elderly and you have any signs that there is a change in their usual behavior, absolutely. Sometimes it's dehydration. Sometimes it's not even a UTI. Sometimes it's just hydrating a little bit and they recover. So if you have a relative, if you have elderly patients, or if you work in a nursing home, you really need to watch for any signs of symptoms of changes. But the majority of the population are not just presenting with a little bit of altered mental status. They are presenting with respiratory symptoms with or without a fever.
Question from our Instagram feed here. Are pregnant people considered at risk?
Pregnant people and immunocompromised patients. Pregnancy is a state of immune compromise. So, yes, we always consider pregnancy a higher risk population.
Let's go to Delray Beach. James on line 11. Go ahead, James. You're on the radio now.
Yes, hi there. Well, my question was for like a normal, healthy person, what kind of a recovery time are you looking at being able to get back to work and get on with your life if you contracted the virus?
Very good question. And again, we're learning about this as more cases come. All the information that we know is from international sites and the few patients that have been repatriated and all the few infections that we have here. The majority of the people, I would say 80 to 85% of the population, will recover probably within a week or less. There will be other cases where we'll have more severe disease. That's about 10% of the population that may have severe respiratory symptoms, pneumonia, underlying medical problems that may take longer.
And the early studies that have come out of China show the older population more at risk. There's some kind of real questions about asked around children and teenagers regarding this virus. But certainly when you look at the very early, very small sample size out of China, it finds as you move further to the right on the demographic side, in other words, older populations tend to be more serious cases.
Patients with comorbidities. Remember, there could be younger people that have multiple comorbidities. So I would like to be very cautious when people say, no, this doesn't affect children. I think if you have multiple medical illnesses, which could be children, adolescents, young adults, or elderly, you are at a higher risk. And protection and caution, it's just of abundance, no reason to panic, but do take precautions.
Doctor, you worked, as I mentioned, on the Zika task force in 2016. What are the lessons from a public health standpoint and for kind of a community who dealt with the Zika virus in 2016 that we can pull forward into questions and concerns in the coronavirus here in 2020?
Well, I think as a community that leaves hurricanes every year, and it's very interesting because with Zika, we prepared and we over-prepared. And then the same with hurricane season. People are like, oh, the hurricane didn't hit us, right? So thank God. I think what we saw with Zika was the community coming together. We saw a lot of support from government officials, from health departments coming together and really understanding as we knew more about the infection, how it was spread. And again, when there is a new disease, we always go overboard. We always take abundance of caution, and then we back off and say, hey, we don't need to do all these additional measures. So I think we learned from the Zika response in terms of operations in our hospitals, how to screen patients, how to effectively communicate, and what kind of information needs to be sent to our public. We learned a lot from Zika, and we're taking those lessons and applying them and making it better. So I feel like with the coronavirus preparedness, it has been actually much better than with Zika, as our teams have already experienced this. We have very short-term memory, and we know that, hey, this seems like Zika all over, but with a different vector and a different disease.
Some of the criticisms that have been leveled against the public health department are very similar, though. They rhyme from what the criticisms were in 2016, and it was criticisms around time of notification, time of test results, and public transparency. How do you hear those today?
I would like the health department to comment on their own opportunities. What I can say is that from our end, the delay in the response has been in obtaining, being able to test people in a timely manner. And as of this week, the Florida Department of Health and the Miami lab is fully operational. And we are now being told that they're going to have capacity to test 7 days a week, which would really assist our physicians.
And two commercial labs are supposed to come online,
yes. So
LabCorp and Quest Diagnostics.
Quest Diagnostics has announced that hopefully by next week they will be operational. We will have to determine what the workflow will be. It's not as easy as to just point and click. There are costs associated with that. The health department tests for free. If you're uninsured, which we have a large population, and now you get a huge bill for a test, who's going to pay for that? They need to validate the test and make sure that the results are accurate. We don't want to start getting the results that are false positives or false negatives. So there are a lot of things that go into play, but I think having the capacity to test will allow us to quarantine people and avoid spread. There are treatments that are being developed and there are vaccines in development, but we all know from a public health response that it's really the capacity to identify quickly, isolate, and take measures.
Regarding the identification, there's been some concerns expressed that the state of Florida's guidelines for testing are still tighter than the Centers for Disease Control guidelines. The CDC has essentially put it into the hands of medical professionals, of doctors, if they have ruled out influenza, for instance, but still suspect, even if somebody hasn't been to China, hasn't been to a country affected, hasn't been around people who have done those kinds of things, that tighter kind of qualification or characteristics, those remain the guidelines in Florida.
Correct. And We just have to follow the Florida Department of Health, even if we want to test outside of those guidelines. Until there is full capacity to test, we're following
the guidelines. But speaking as an infectious disease specialist, would you like? Does it make sense to broaden that out, or would that capture perhaps many people?
I think we have to be what we call sensitive and specific. You want to capture people, but you don't want to start doing, for example, mammographies on every woman at every age. You want to capture the people that needs to be captured. So you have finite resources, and you want to use those finite resources appropriately. You want to test the people who need to be tested, but there has to be some flexibility, and that's what we're hoping for. That we're gonna have to loosen our criteria, but as of today, we're still following the strict criteria because the testing is being controlled by the Department of Health, and we need to follow their guidance.
Dr. Abo, I want to share with the audience, when you and I greeted each other today, we shook hands.
We did.
Is that still permissible?
I think it's still permissible, but we need to wash our hands before and after we shake them. And we are Hispanic, in a Hispanic community where people are very affectionate, and it's going to be inevitable that people, you know, but I think social distancing as much as possible is recommended. And again, hand hygiene to me is the most important thing. And what you learn in kindergarten is what you still need to do today. Wash your hands.
We shook hands. Hello, but I'll say goodbye and thank you from over here. How about that?
It's been a pleasure being here. And thank you so much for having me. And thank you all for calling. And I hope we answer some of your questions.
Dr. Lillian Abo, she is the Chief of Infection Prevention and Control at Jackson Health System. Doctor, thank you again for spending the time with us here on the Florida Roundup.
Thank you.
Still to come, one reporter's trek through the health system with a respiratory illness and what it may tell us about whether the system is prepared for a serious outbreak. That's still to come. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Health officials are trying to reassure the public about the spread of the coronavirus. The Florida Surgeon General has said that there's so much that's still not known about the disease. What we do know is that it possesses a greater risk to elderly people and people with weakened immune systems, as we just heard. There's a lot of people who get cold symptoms, certainly, and they're probably wondering what they should do to take care of themselves at this time. And yes, we are still in the flu season. Rosemary O'Hara is the opinions page editor for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, a regular guest here on the South Florida Roundup. She wrote a column about getting sick recently and her trek through the health service industry. She joins us now via FaceTime audio. Rosemary, I'm sorry you couldn't make it into the studio. How are you feeling?
I'm much better, Tom. Thanks so much for asking.
Oh, good. The official diagnosis was pneumonia. Is that correct?
That's right. Yes.
Yeah.
And
so take us back to the beginning when you started to feel some of those early symptoms that can be described best as what? Cold-like symptoms.
Well, not even a cold. I started with a deep stabbing pain in my lower lung, and I knew it wasn't a cold, it wasn't the flu, it was something I'd never felt before. And within a day, I was gurgling, and within a day and a half, I heard this really loud whistle from my lungs. And frankly, it was quite remarkable, and it was almost like, wow, listen to that whistle in my lungs. You know, it's almost like break out the spoons and, you know, we can have a little music here.
You can laugh about it now, Rosemary, but I don't think you were laughing at the time.
No, it was scary.
Yeah.
Because I think as most people experience, healthcare has changed. It is not easy to get in to see your doctor, which was the first thing that I tried to do. But, you know, there wasn't same day appointments are a thing of the past. So I ended up at an urgent care center. I'm sure other people, that's their only option, too. And when I went there and the doctor listened to my famous whistle, he just, you know, took this giant step back and asked, had I been to any of the countries where coronavirus is known to be prevalent? And then he gave me a prescription, a Z-Pack and some prednisone, and said, you know, you have to go to the hospital for an x-ray or to this other clinic. So he was going to send me to a hospital.
Yeah.
And instead I went to another clinic, got an x-ray, and sure enough, I got the diagnosis that I had pneumonia.
But you went through that protocol, that suggested recommended protocol about have you been to China? Have you been to South Korea? Have you been in contact with people in the last 2 weeks that have been to those locations?
I got asked, had I traveled there? I did not get asked, had I been around people who had traveled there? And as I only just learned today, I was around somebody who had just been in China 10 days earlier.
Tell me more about that realization today, Rosemary.
Okay. Well, you know, I'll share with you, we had a party at the Sun Sentinel, a going away party for some of our colleagues. And about 16 of us have gotten sick from that party. And there was one of our former colleagues who had just been in China. I only just discovered that. But here was the journey that I went on after I got diagnosed with pneumonia. And so many of us got sick at this party. So I discovered if you get fever, cough, and respiratory shortness of breath, you're supposed to call the health department. You're not just supposed to go to your doctor like I did or tried to. You're supposed to call the health department. So what happens when you call the health department? Mm-hmm. What do they tell you to do? And, you know, they only asked, first off, I tried to talk to the director to find out, what are you telling people who call you? The health department won't take phone calls and answer media questions. So I wound up calling as a patient. And I said, you know, I've got pneumonia. And I was asked, well, have you visited, you know, one of these countries? No, I hadn't. But I did not get asked, had I been around somebody who had. Hmm. So I got two questions. What were my symptoms? And had I visited any of these countries? And when I said I had not and my symptoms were improving, I felt like this person couldn't get off the phone fast enough. And now, you know, I mean, a lot of us are wondering, you know, what did so many of us who were at this party get sick from?
Yeah.
Was it just the flu? I know it's a terrible flu this season. But I have to wonder, do I have coronavirus? But I don't think the public health people were wondering whether I did. And I was disappointed by that.
You were disappointed that they weren't more curious about it.
Exactly. There was no curiosity. I still have not gotten a call back from the health department with the questions that I had to ask. And I think, you know, if people are supposed to call the health department first, wouldn't you think that the health department would want to use the media to help get the message out about what they're supposed to do? Okay, call us, and then we're going to do this. Here's our protocol. Here's how we're going to help you if you've got pneumonia or shortness of breath, but we don't want you to infect others. Mm-hmm. I found a lack of response, a lack of curiosity.
Did they talk at all about suggestions around self-quarantining or social distancing as you described your symptoms?
No, not a word. No.
And at any point as you were going through this, Rosemary, did the specter of coronavirus come into the realm of possibility for you?
It did, because, you know, it was just so remarkable how so many of us got sick. At least 16 of us at a party that maybe had 35, 40 people. So we've all been abuzz about how many of us got sick, including a great many with respiratory, some flu, cold symptoms, fevers. So, you know, it's a remarkable occurrence. And so what might have caused that? Then with the news of coronavirus, you know, you wonder if that's it or if it's a flu. But there was something in the air that night.
Yeah, I hope your colleagues are doing better. You're clearly doing better as well. And for those of us who have, you know, had the flu in our homes or if not experienced it directly this year, hope everybody is doing better or finding their way through it. As you take a step back and you've thought a lot about this, Rosemary, your experiences tell us what about the Department of Health in Florida and really its engagement with the health delivery system. Certainly the patient in your case, but the health delivery system, the urgent care facilities, the hospitals, the doctors and nurses themselves. What do you think?
I think that there's not been a Marshall Plan-like response to dealing with this. I've heard, I don't have any sense that the urgent care centers are part of a network that are reporting this virus, at least on the day that I was there. I don't believe I got reported as a possibility. I've heard from mayors who are afraid that the EMS system is on the front line of this outbreak, and how do they handle cases? Even in the intake of the hospitals are saying, we really don't want to see people like you, you know, because we don't want people who can be treated outside the hospital to come in and clog up the system and expose other people to the virus. So I don't think the healthcare system feels like it's working as one in responding. And frankly, as you were just discussing with your last guest, you know, at the state level, it's like the Governor DeSantis wants to be the face for the communications coming out about this. Yes, he finally let the Surgeon General talk, but it's largely coming from the governor's office, and he's not a doctor. And so, and these county health department people, they won't speak. And so we're just left with a lack of information, you know, questions, and we saw the same thing in the Zika outbreak. You know, Governor Scott wanted to be at the microphone like he was during a hurricane. And, you know, I understand that on one sense, but I also want to hear from the doctors, and I want to hear from the local epidemiologists how they're handling things.
Yeah, I will say, Rosemary, on our statewide program in the noon hour, we were able to speak with the Deputy Secretary of Health in Florida, who is a medical doctor. But I'll share with you from one reporter to the next, it took quite a bit of work to get that and a lot of patience and persistence to get it. But that's not necessarily rare in these kinds of instances.
And consider how big a statewide NPR audience is, that you had to struggle to get a doctor from the state to get on and speak to the many millions of people that you reach and who they should be wanting to reach with information. What's with that?
Well, and at the end of the day, they did come on and we did talk to that doctor. And for what it's worth, you can find that audio later today at our website at WLRN.org in the podcast for the Florida Roundup as well. Rosemary, you're 80%, 85%, 90%, 100%?
I still have this nagging tickle in my lungs, and I'm working too hard, and I'm wondering, God, am I getting a relapse?
Well, there's something coming up March 17th that I can imagine has been occupying a lot of your time as well as the election approaches.
Yes, it's huge.
All right, Rosemary, listen, we do appreciate you sharing your personal story, and thanks so much for spending the time here, and go get some rest and drink plenty of fluids, okay?
And hugs from afar,
hugs,
Tom.
Hugs from afar, all right. The South Florida Sun Sentinel opinion page editor, Rosemary O'Hara, with us via FaceTime here on the South Florida Roundup. Finally on the Roundup this week, primary day less than 3 weeks away now here in Florida. Mail-in ballots are out and early voting underway in some parts of South Florida already. WLRN has been asking voters about what issues they care about most as Election Day approaches on March 17th. Rogers Clausen from Boynton Beach is among the voters we've heard from.
I'm actually registered as a Republican, so for me, it feels like the party has been hijacked by basically just one person, and then, can't say that everything Trump has done has been, you know, terrible, and I think he's asking some good questions every, you know, once in a while. But for the most part, it's been extremely disappointing, the constant rollbacks of environmental protections are kind of across the board.
Darla Cooper, Pompano Beach. I just switched from being a lifelong registered Republican to a Democrat just under the deadline because I want to vote for Pete. And I'm disappointed that my vote doesn't mean anything, that I couldn't have put my support behind him in time for him to continue. I think that we should be on the same day voting across the country at the same time and no results broadcast or announced until every last one of them is in. I haven't decided between Biden and Bernie.
If you'd like to add your voice to our voter voices, look for the Florida primary banner on our homepage. You'll find it at WLRN.org. Now, you can vote early in Miami-Dade and Monroe counties right now. It begins Saturday in Broward and Palm Beach counties, and the deadline to request a vote-by-mail ballot is also Saturday. That'll do it for the South Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Alexandra Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations is Peter J. Mertz. WLRN's director of radio programming is Jason Zabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting WLRN. The program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist.